Neil. Andrew.
Hello, my relatives. It's amazing to be here. First one of these I've ever been to. Been to anarchist events. Been here, been there. Never been here. I'll be back. I bring you greetings from the elders of Catua Band of Cherokee, from the Colorado chapter of the American Indian Movement, and from Dworthy Lott, otherwise known as Leonard Peltier, who today, as I speak to you, continues to sit in a cage to federal prison at Leavenworth, Kansas, not for anything. Anyone, including even his prosecutor at any point in the past 20 years, has been prepared to say they actually believe he did, but rather as a symbol of the arbitrary ability of the federal government of the United States to repress the legitimate aspirations to liberation of indigenous people within its claim boundaries, put the emphasis there on claim. There is a difference between claim and reality. And I think everybody here is cognizant of it. That's the reason Leonard's there. It's a message sent to all of us about the arbitrary, capricious, and ultimately cost-prohibitive nature of standing on your rights. You know the drill in this country. You're all imbued with rights, they say, in this status enterprise. All imbued with rights. We can enumerate those rights, and you will maintain and possess those rights right up until the moment when you try to exercise them. The message is don't. The message is don't. With regard to Leonard, that message was repealed by taking him out of that cage and putting him back where he belongs, which is with the people for whom he struggled. I'm not supposed to be talking to you. I'm supposed to be removed. Says Fox. That new program they've got called the Ward Churchill Factor that runs where Bill O'Reilly used to run every night. If I was on Madison Avenue, I'd be paying kickbacks to that guy. You couldn't buy the publicity he's giving me. And ultimately, whether he knows it or not, whether he intends it or not, that he's giving you. It goes to a single phrase that comes within the paradigm that is conventionally referred to as speaking truth to power. I don't. I have nothing to say to power as it defines itself in this country or in this world. Power is incapable of listening. Power does not hear. Power knows everything I would be saying to it better than I do. It could teach me about its own mechanics. Why would I speak to power? There is no point in speaking to power. You speak to people. You speak truth in the teeth of power. So, that's what I did. That's what I've done for a long time. That's what I'm going to continue to do, whether it's in a classroom at the University of Colorado, where I wasn't always. I did what I'm doing now before I went there. In the day I leave, and inevitably, under whatever circumstances I leave, I will be leaving. I'm not wedded to the place. I will be continuing to do what it is that I do, and that's to speak to you. And speak the truth as I see it. And the truth as I saw it on the 11th of September, 2001, was summed up in a phrase uttered by Malcolm X when he was asked a question on the night of John Kennedy assassination. What do you think this means? They ask him. He said, simple case, chickens coming home to roost. Yeah. Nice. What happened on the September 11, 2001 was, to my mind, chickens coming home to roost. But I framed that in a very specific set of circumstances. And I was doing what I usually do in the morning, sitting in a word processor, working on an articulation when a telephone rang. There was a friend who said, is your TV on? And I said, no. And she said, well, turn it on, because somebody just blew a plane into the World Trade Center. So I did. That caught my attention. This doesn't happen every day. I turned on the TV and watched the second plane come in real time. Watched the buildings come down in real time. And before the first building had gone down. Maybe even before the second plane came in. I don't really remember, but certainly before either of the towers came down on all three channels, which were mirror images of one another. The cameras were set up. All three channels, you were seeing the same image, and you were hearing virtually boilerplate the same description of what it was that was happening. A senseless act. You think about that for a nanosecond. Somebody has hijacked not one, not two, not even three, but four aircraft in synchronicity. They're hitting both towers, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and who knows what the fourth one was intended to hit. But this is not happening by accident. It is happening in concert. Some people are doing what it is that's being done and showing them real time, live on TV, in the way that it's happening. It has a purpose. It is not senseless if it has a purpose. It is already being described, framed for the public consciousness and consumption as something that is senseless, but obviously it has a purpose. What might that purpose be? If you want to ascertain the purpose, you need to see the motive. What might motivate this? Well, it occurred to me somebody might be slightly upset about 500,000 dead Iraqi children, confirmed, as having been the cause and consequence of 5 years of stringent embargo imposed upon Iraq by the federal government in order to export and impose freedom upon the Iraqi regime, the Ba'athist regime, under the rubric of what George Bush, the 41st, had described as being the message of what we say goes. There's that freedom for you. George, the son, says they hate our freedom. George, the father, articulated freedom in those terms. You can understand why it might be hated when the cost of not doing what you're told is the destruction of an entire coming generation. Might that be upsetting, particularly when you understand that the reality of it has been articulated to the general public of this country, and the general public's response was basically to yawn and pursue the latest state-of-the-art cell phone and the perfect cappuccino as being their priorities in life. And where would you find the hub of that mentality? Well, I suspected perhaps that one of the hubs of that mentality would be situated in the heart of the military complex of the United States, since it was a military equation that was causing the embargo to be effective. And I think that was probably pretty effectively symbolized in targeting the center of what in Pentagon speak is referred to the command and control infrastructure of the U.S. military enterprise, and that would be called the Pentagon, and that had just been hit. But the Pentagon does nothing, nothing separate from the economic interest as defined by the elite of the United States, and what would be the symbolic heart of the economic enterprise that is the United States? Well, clearly that would be the World Trade Center. Therein situated what I described as a technocratic core at the heart of empire. Technocrats, people who are proficient in performing functions for purposes of profit maximization with a collateral effect, a consequential effect of the mass immiseration of persons worldwide, and ultimately the carnage embodied in the symbolism of Iraq. People who perfectly well understood the consequence of their project as being starving and dying children. Not just in Iraq, but in the sweatshops in Malaysia, in the sweatshops in Guam, in the sweatshops along the Mexican border. The essential enslavement of entire populations of other countries. This to improve their self-entitlement to a quality of life unrivaled, materially at least, in the history of humanity. How to respond to that when an informed public yawns, when an informed public turns a blind eye. That led to the phrase out of what initially was a blog piece written on the afternoon of September 11th as I tried to make sense of this for myself, to make sense of it in terms that it can be sensical, rendered sensical to others as an alternative to the kind of gibberish that was coming out of the mass media to indoctrinate the public to accept propositions like they hate our freedom and they're evil. Oh yeah. Written on the afternoon of the 11th itself, posted on Dark Knight Field Notes the following day. The phrase, comparing that technocratic core to little Eichmann's, Eichmann, the epitome of evil in some people's mind, a name that resonates without understanding, because of the association with a particular genocide performed by a particular regime at a particular point in Eastern Europe. Eichmann, the overseer of the process known as singular, the Holocaust. Well, the first response comes mostly from the left and demonstrates the profundity of ignorance that associates with the use of the term and the nature of the process. There's no one in those buildings, those innocent Americans, one and all. You remember that point in time when innocent American was all one word. Those innocent Americans had killed no one. Stunning. Because Eichmann himself, having been abducted from Argentina in 1960, he had escaped. He sought sanctuary in South America under Perón. He had received it. He was a manager in a Volkswagen plant when the Mossad caught him, whisked him away, took him to Israel, put him on trial. With survivors of the process as witnesses, the survivors of the victims of the process as prosecutors, no one accused him, even in Israel, of having killed a single human being, Jewish or not. Eichmann, the real Eichmann, the big Eichmann, was a bureaucrat. He was a logistician. Well said, succinct, very much to the point. He was a logistician. He arranged train schedules. He arranged the transshipment of gas from the manufacturing points to the chambers in which it would be used. He arranged the transshipment of the gold extracted from the teeth and from the frames of the eyeglasses to be melted down in ingots and placed in Swiss banks. He arranged for the distribution of the clothing and the shorn hair. But he harmed, in a direct sense, no one. He performed technical functions with an amazing degree of proficiency. And even in his own context, the big Eichmann, the real Eichmann, was symbolic. He symbolized the little Eichmanns that worked under him, because he did not do it alone. He required an organization of individuals who, in full knowledge of the consequences of the project in which they were engaged, were prepared to perform their functions without moral twinge, with a proficiency that made the genocidal process efficient, maximally efficient. They did it for the status. They did it for the stature. They did it for the sense of belonging to a self-anointedly superior group, and for no other reason. That's his own bureau, the bureaucrats under him. But he symbolized as well the technicians that manufactured the gas. They didn't even administer it. They simply produced it, free in conscience. He represented the engineers and the brakemen on the trains who could see what the cargo was in the cars that were transporting a population to its annihilation, but they killed no one either. And the engineers who kept the trains' trestles functioning in the face of Allied bombing, and those who provided the various other components of technical necessity to make industrial scale killing possible and to work in an efficient manner. He was symbolic even in his own place, in his own time. I took this from Hannah Arendt, who was a noted scholar of the experience of the Holocaust, and who asked for the assignment as a journalist to go from New York to Tel Aviv to witness the trial. She wanted to confront the real Eichmann. In her mind, he, epitomizing evil to her, expected to confront a monstrosity. And what she found instead was a mouse. An absolutely nondescript little everyman. And the true magnitude of the horror began to penetrate. And what it was that penetrated was not the malevolence of Eichmann as the Nazi, as the overseer of the Holocaust, but his absolute banality. His everyman dimension. Not that he was a Nazi, but that in his everyman capacity, he obviously and clearly signaled the fact that everyone bound up in mass state of society was potentially him. Him, his very absence of unique and monstrous characteristics was that which was most horrifying about him. Going with the program renders you Eichmann. Going with the program voids your humanity. Going with the program makes you not just complicit, but a participant in the process of genocide. Eichmann was not in that building. The little Eichmanns were there. The first response from the left was to start screaming about food service workers and janitors, passers-by, and 18-month-old children. If there is a definition out there that makes a guy who pushes a broom for a living a technocrat, a technician of empire, or something comparable to that, I'd really like to hear what it is. Obviously, I was not talking about the food service workers, the janitors, the passers-by, or the children. I was talking about something very specific that was understood, that was in the formulation. That was a diversion. A diversion from the real aspect of genocidal mentality with which this society is imbued. We don't need to deal with it quite in as abstract a terms as I formulated it then, and I can pick a relatively local example to make the point. Across the bay, we're on this side of the bay. I'm getting confused where I am at any given moment. All right, this side of the bay, the San Francisco side of the bay, the west side of the bay, you have a financial district here, yes?
Yeah.
And in that financial district, you have little taverns and restaurants and bars and clubs where the people who work in those facilities, in the enterprises which form the financial district, congregate to socialize like everybody else after work, after their jobs are done for the day. Yeah? Well, in the middle of that, so it was explained to me by a couple of my students who were out here in spring break at the event last night. They'd flown into the airport, taken BART into town, got off the BART train, were waiting for their ride, went into a bar to have a beer while they waited. The bar was called something like 40 Indians. Now, you can sort of see where this might be going. As it turns out, the 40 Indians are hanging from the ceiling. They're vintage motorcycles, the old Indian brand, the first Indian brand motorcycle before they came up with a new project, okay, to honor Indians. Okay, they got the bikes hanging there as decor. But given the theme of the place, which really is not oriented to motorcycles, despite the decoration, the guy collects these old bikes, I guess. He collects other things as well. It's memorabilia from the Indian Wars. So he's got display cases with things that he's collected over the years. He's got Custer's spurs or something like that, he says. He's got guidons from the 10th Cavalry. He's got this, he's got that, and then he's got this one particular display which got my students' interest, and this is what it was they brought to me. There's a handful of human teeth laid there with a placard that explains the significance of the fact that they're in the case. And it says, these are the teeth of Custer's squaw, okay, after he knocked them out of her head. Now, I don't know whether these are Montecito's teeth or not, but the reality of the story is that great American hero, that symbol of the caning of the West, took a young woman who was the daughter of Black Kettle, the peace leader of the Cheyenne, after they were massacred. That camp was massacred on the Ouachita River in November of 1868. And he kept her as a concubine for several years until he tired of her and cast her aside. He had children with her, so you've got Custer descendants who are Cheyennes. I didn't know he had knocked her teeth out. I don't know, as I said, whether these are in fact are. But assuming that he did, that was part of the discipline to keep her in sexual servitude, that noble figure of a man. And they are now a trophy for the edification of the yuppie elite in downtown San Francisco. And I got to ask you, think about it for a second. What kind of a twisted fucking mentality would turn this into a trophy that you could be proud of and hand down as an heirloom from generation to generation in your family? That's the owner of the bar. But more to the point, what kind of mentality imbues the people who habituate the bar that turn it into a place where they socialize and have recreation, fun, they find this to be acceptable kind of adornment to their environment? And I've got an answer for you, and that answer is Eichmann. Eichmann. That is the mentality of Eichmann. Big Eichmann and little Eichmann. The good Germans that made that process possible are synonymous with the good Americans who voted for George Bush or thought that John Kerry was an alternative. And that explains the blind eye turned to a half million Iraqi children. That's an entire coming generation, because for every dead, there are three more who are never going to grow up other than in a twisted and physically deformed manner as a result of what's been done to them in order to impose the United States will, and that's genocide. When you talk about it being imposed in a country of barely 20 million people, a half million children is the future. The future was denied in the interest of American domination of the rest of the planet in order to support a material way of life and a mentality which is absolutely on its face indefensible to anyone with a scintilla of moral integrity. And explains a lot more than that. It explains the Iraqi children shot in the head for the sin of throwing rocks against a country that had occupied their territory and placed them in refugee camps for two consecutive generations heading into the third. That's the reality of the Intifada. Every round that was fired and every aspect of Israeli dominance in Palestine is owed to this country, which has provided it on the basis of creating a certain order of stability in the Middle East that enhances the U.S. position there. That is U.S. taxpayer-subsidized Holocaust that is going on in Palestine as well. And that Holocaust is not restricted to the Middle East. It is not the Gulf region. You would have 3 million Indo-Chinese that would be involved in that for the last imperial adventure. You could have a few Panamanians. You could have a few Grenadians. You could have Central Americans up the yin-yang. You could have South Africans or Southern Africans for the maintenance of imperial dominance in that region to protect shipping lanes that occurred during the 1980s. The bloodbath in Angola, oh yeah, that would come home to roost as well. You can take it back to Nogun Ree in the United States imposing partition in the name of freedom upon another country in East Asia. Then you can take it back from there to the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in order to send a message that what we say goes in the aftermath of World War II, sending that signal to Joe Stalin. But the nuclear bombings weren't the worst of what happened in Japan. You'd have Curtis LeMay's firebombings prelude to that, where they intentionally set out to incinerate civilians using low-level incendiary attacks. The Great Tokyo Fire Raid accounted for 120,000 people in one night, and that was one of 150 cities subjected to similar treatment as a part of pattern policy in war crimes. Absolute defiance of the Hague Convention on Aerial Warfare that valorize them, because no one remembers LeMay's air force as being composed of war criminals on the scale of Hermann Göring, and Hermann Göring did nothing in comparison to what it was that was done to Japan during the Second World War. You can trace it back to the last Indian War of the 19th century, which was actually conducted in the Philippines. 600,000 to 1.5 million so-called morals slaughtered in order to free the Philippine Islands from the Spanish Empire, in order that the United States could colonize it as a forward basing area, strategic interest on the far side of the Pacific, manifest destiny extended beyond the boundary into the Asian mainland itself. Yeah, that was a genocide perpetrated then, 1899 to 1902. Not much taught in U.S. history books today, not much known even on the left, even among the opposition. And the Philippines slaughter began barely 10 years after the mass grave was filled with corpses of wounded knee, the consummation of the so-called Indian Wars. And now you're into a string of massacres that runs back uninterruptedly all the way to the Wappingers. The Wappingers, which was not the name for themselves, are the Indians who supposedly sold the island of Manhattan to the Dutch for a handful of beads and trinkets. And that was a rental agreement which was breached by the Dutch and resolved by virtue of immobilizing a militia and sending it up the island in order to dispense with the Wappingers, which they did in a very efficient fashion, so efficient that they did not believe that they would be believed when they came back that the mission had been accomplished. In sort of order to prove what it was they'd done and how effectively they'd done it, they severed the heads of the male leadership and took them back in baskets to display to the citizenry in what was then called New Amsterdam. And the citizenry was jubilant. They now owned the island, and they vanquished the foe, and they celebrated with a sporting event in the form of kickball, and the balls that were used were the heads of the Wappingers. That kickball game occurred virtually on the foundations of where the World Trade Center once stood. Oh yeah, those foundations are set at the foot of something called Wall Street. Funny name. Must have been named for Mr. Wall. No. That was the enclosure of the slave market that formed the core of the New York, what becomes the New York economy during its early phases. So among the other chickens, you could say, that were coming home to roost would be the ghosts of the U.S. portion of the transatlantic slave trade. And we wouldn't want to leave out the Chinese who were brought into lay the track and the ties for the Transcontinental Railroad to bind the country together so it could have a coherent economy, could have a rational efficiency in its evolution at the time. You've heard the term, you don't have a Chinaman's chance. You don't have a Chinaman's chance of surviving this experience. They're importing you to be worked to death, not only on the rail lines, but in the deep shaft mines for gold at places like Homestake, Black Hills, and on and on and on. That's a serious kind of karma that's getting balanced out there. And the idea is you cannot, as the United States has entitled itself to do, as a society, as a polity, engage in that kind of genocidal comportment towards brown-skinned others in perpetuity and with impunity. If you push like that long enough, somebody gonna push back in time. This being a fairly simple proposition in my mind, but not a particularly pleasant one, you see. It's not pleasant for them out there. Hey, newsflash, it's not going to be pleasant when they're responding kind because no one has done what is necessary to prevent their babies from being slaughtered. And there is going to be no more impunity. Now we got a question of security, and that question of security is being raised all over the place by September 12th. And they're talking about counterterrorism units and cloning out the Delta Force. Okay, they've talked since about legitimating torture and building tiger cages in Guantanamo Bay and building secret bases in Thailand and elsewhere where they can put inconvenient, potential, knowledgeable terrorist captives in order to undergo interesting interrogation techniques to gather the information necessary to roll up and repeal the terrorist cells and networks that are out there to increase levels of security, which has to do with compromising rights, among other things, within the United States, of instituting a new order of counterintelligence that's aimed at the citizenry in order to prevent there being material support gathered and put forth to terrorist organizations. Ask Lynn Stewart about that. And on and on and on. You think that's going to work? You think CIA is going to crack this? Well, I don't think the people in this room do, but the general public, I mean, my God, how much more transparent it could be. Central Intelligence Agency was totally blindsided with the collapse of the Soviet Union. That's how precise their information gathering seems to be. They had 120,000, 200,000, and even more informants on the ground in Southeast Asia in 1968, and they couldn't predict the Tet Offensive. And they're going to be able to track down terrorist cells that are well-financed and efficient? I doubt it. But if you think this formulation for counterterrorism is in any way going to provide security for people who are serious about retaliation for what it is that's being done in the world, ask the Israelis about it. That's the world's most highly developed security state of the type in question, and much smaller than this one, and therefore much easier to defend. And you got 14-year-old kids walking into cafes and blowing them right out the windows whenever they decide to do it. If anybody in this country wants to hang their hat on that for the personal well-being and the well-being of their children and their future generation, hey, just leave me out, okay? Because it hasn't worked any place that it's ever been tried, and it's not likely to work in this one either. The best framing I've ever heard on how security would work: if you don't want them to do that to you, then stop killing their babies. Just that simple. But how might you do that? Well, I got a really radical and profound postulation in the offending essay, the one that's caused Bill O'Reilly to go absolutely batshit over the last 2 months. Okay? It's called law enforcement. Law enforcement. Oh, yeah. Scary concept. You think about 100,000 cops in the street and building more prisons and putting us in it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the real big laws, the ones that count. The ones that have to do with the laws of war and the fact that you cannot target civilian populated facilities and call the results collateral damage. The ones that say you cannot torture, you cannot starve, you cannot intimidate in a fashion that the United States and its collaterals, its allies, tend to do that. That these are crimes, the crimes against articulated international law. The idea is, if you're going to talk about law enforcement, you're going to talk about the big boys, that is the government itself, obeying the law first and foremost, and the citizens having an obligation, a right, a duty to enforce that law upon their own government by, I'll go back to Malcolm X again, any means necessary. You got that, Lindsay? That's fundamental. It's Nuremberg Doctrine. The default and the culpability of the German population was not having done what it was that was necessary to put its government on a legal leash and compelling it thereby to comport itself with fundamental regard for human dignity, decency, the right to life itself. Oh yeah, that kind of formulation. When you start running their own rhetoric back at you, back at them, they start to get a little irritated, you see. Because that's a lens and an articulation that the entire population has been indoctrinated into already. You know, you go out and you see the little sign as soon as you get into a car on public transportation system, the signs are alongside the road. Buckle up, it's the law. Put out your cigarette, it's the law. Okay, the law speaks in a certain kind of cadence in this society that cannot be replicated theoretically or through exemplary action or anything else. If you can frame what it is you're trying to do in terms of law, legality, the necessity to comply with law, you have a constituent audience out there that is vast. It's a matter of framing. And that's what it is that set the dogs, the mad dogs on the right, loose on me in particular. Not that I'm the only one who's ever said this. Chalmers Johnson has said it even more harshly at book length, but he said it in a way that spoke to the mind exclusively, not to the gut, and I'm going to try to go for the gut. I'm going to try to prevent you from avoiding what it is that I said by making what I said something that's going to stick in your mind.
The people attacking you arranged 9/11.
Which is to say that brown-skinned people couldn't come up with and carry this out on their own. It served their interest in it, and they seized on it, and that's unquestionably true, but that's different than you got to have a smart white guy thinking up everything you're going to do if you happen to be imbued with a brown skin. I got no particular love for fundamentalism of any kind, which means I got no particular love for Osama bin Laden, but by God, brown-skinned people can and will and must do it on their own. Law, which is anathema in a state of articulation to most people of an anarchist persuasion, myself included, at least as we experience it in day-to-day reality, is something that we can use in the fashion of jujitsu to pursue our own agenda. It is illegal for a state to comport itself in the manner that states must comport themselves if they are to maintain themselves in the face of the interests of the people. It is that simple. We can use the law in legal articulation, a Bakuninist version of international order, in such a way as to undo the integrity of the statist system. So it's in our interest, in an immediate sense, tactically, in order to be able to reach people, to rely on arguments such as not flaunting law, but insisting upon law, important law, before you get to regulatory law, both in that narrow and immediately self-interested sense, but in a longer and strategic sense as well. It provides us a framework of understanding of how we can break down the international statist order and turn it into an order of affinity among ourselves, and that truly is an anarchist vision. That's the project I'm pursuing now. Further articulation of that will be forthcoming, Bill O'Reilly notwithstanding. And that is something I think that in a collective elaboration we all have a vested interest in. This particular thing that's happening now with them focusing me is way beyond me. I have a particular voice and a particular cadence and a particular message that they would like to have silenced, but the fact of the matter is that I'm simply the kickoff on a general repeal of cadences and messages and voices that are not felt to be comfortable and convenient to the Newt Gingriches of the world. And Newt Gingrich went on Joe Scarborough in the first week of this particular thing that's happening with me right now and announced the broader agenda, which was to roll back. He began with, in the academy, since they've already captured the media and use it as a basically a propaganda vehicle for articulation of the message that is desired by the status quo, they're going after the academy next. And I am to signal the kickoff on a elimination of, well, you've got several studies that are at issue here. His iteration in brief form was ethnic studies, women's studies, and queer studies have no basis of justification for existence anywhere in the academy. They are simply to be eliminated. And along with that, while we're at it, let's take out critical studies of every sort. Anything that challenges and interrogates the articulations of the status quo is to be eliminated. The function of the institution, which should be privatized, by the way, is essentially to be converted into an advanced vo-tech where critical skills necessary to the corporate functioning of the system of domination exported and imposed upon the planet by the United States are to be imparted to elites, those who are designated to be part of it, while they are indoctrinated in the red, white, blue version of ideological conformity that is subscribed to by the Jerry Falwells, the Pat Robertsons, the Newt Gingriches, and the David Horowitzes of the world. This is not a new message either, by the way. It finds its roots far back in the 20th century, but one of the clearest articulations I've ever encountered having been made of it was made across the bay at Berkeley when Clark Kerr was in charge of that institution. He wrote a very important book that is almost entirely ignored by the opposition now called The Use of the University, in which he describes students as being raw material that would be shaped by a workforce composed of faculty that were managed by the administrators of the institution on the basis of strategic government and mostly corporate functioning, funding in order to provide people who had the requisite skills and ideological conformity to perform the task necessary to make the country consistent with its ideals and principles. Now that was written in about 1961-62, at least that was when it was published. And that is exactly the model they're attempting to actualize on a nationwide scale right now. And the fact of the matter is that they are successful in that, having already captured the mainstream media and corporatized that. If they can convert the universities, those staging areas, into this kind of sounding board for their own ideology, they will eliminate things like this with relative ease. We've got to work together on these things and understand the commonality of interest that we have. things that may be ideologically marginal to you, and academic freedom happens to be to me. That's not exactly what I set out as a role for myself, to become a poster boy of academic freedom. I've got other projects in mind. Okay? But you have to understand that those with the power in a social and political, and dare I call it forceful sense, literally a military sense, within this society, they have the prerogative, the power to dictate terms. They impose the terms of struggle upon us. We have no alternative to meet them on their own ground. And that's the reason I have in the tradition of the people whose area I live in, which is Cheyenne. I'm not Cheyenne. But the Cheyenne have this thing called a picket pin. When you really got danger coming at the people, you pin yourself with the picket that you would stake out your horse so it doesn't wander away in the night. You stake yourself to the ground and you don't back up any further than the length of the rope attached to that pin. Well, I've staked out. I don't give an inch on this one. Okay, there is no backward to go with it. And that's something that's not just true for me, but it's true for all of us. We got to meet this one head on, and we got to beat it, and we're going to have no ground left to stand on and over the mouth of. That's pretty much where things stand with me, and I think that means that's where things stand with us right now. There's a collectivity of interest in this, and there needs to be a collectivity of response. And I'll work with you on your own ground as you define it. I request a mutual or reciprocating respect and regard. You work with me, too. And together, we can beat the Newt Gingriches and the David Horowitzes and the Bill Owenses and the Lynn Cheneys and the William Bennetts and ultimately the Dick Cheneys and the Donald Rumsfelds and the George Bushes of the world. Bay Area, kind of closing now. It's not the thing I would normally close with, but something that's sort of a refresher course to the community here. It goes like this. Power to the people!